stories to happen and then react. We look at what's out there and anticipate stories and then and seek them out and then push them into the mainstream, Knight adds. We won't let the Reagan administration define the news for us. In the 14 months since their first broadcast on November 22nd, 1986, the Contragate team, three producers and a handful of reporters scattered from Latin America to the South Pacific, has broken story after story about dirty dealings in America's foreign policy, the duplicity, violence, and corruption there. They've uncovered sometimes sound so far-fetched you might think the reporters were jamming the airwaves with paranoia. That is until the same stories start turning up on the 7 o'clock news. But Contragate does it with a difference, says Bernstein, where the mainstream media goes for what he calls the clean story told by bureaucrats in three-piece suits, Contragate goes, guests have included drug dealers, arms smugglers, CIA agents, legislators, along with well-known military analysts and investigative journalists. Each show begins with a summary of the day's headlines and then offers a main story featuring interviews from the streets of Haiti or the streets of New Zealand, from disillusioned Contras to the most fervent of mercenaries. Contragate began in the fall of 1986 with Bernstein, a freelance journalist, approached WBAI with research he'd done on connections between Contra funding and the cocaine trade. Wow. Bernstein print editors would only go so far with the story, but Knight, then WBAI news director, and others at the station trusted the documentation and thought the American public had a right to hear it. We're running out of time. And I just wanted to share a little bit of this story when Dennis Bernstein and Robert Knight, hosts of WBAI Contragate, there's a lovely photo of two very young men on this article. And I'm just amazed. And it's really wonderful to realize how powerful and how relevant, not just this program was, but how this radio station was, because it allowed this kind of dynamic, creative, resource programming to exist, and I think it's very possible for it to continue to exist, you know, for the talent to come together with the airwaves, and we can begin to change the world. So stay tuned for WBAI coming up in just a moment. Will be a broadcast of Hour of the Wolf with Jim Freund. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program of science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This week, our guest, recorded a month ago, is Nalo Hopkinson, a wonderful writer and person. And we're also going to have a couple of movie reviews. Happy Walpurgisnacht, and stay tuned.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. If you want to think about it that way, every story boils down to a question of identity. Who's the murderer? Am I being true to myself and my principles? Which one is dumb and which one is dumber? The great thing about science fiction is that it can take this core concern and build a scenario that makes the question of who are you or who am I quite literal. In Transcendence, Will Caster, a noted scientist working in the field of AI, played by Johnny Depp, is shot by a follower of an anti-technology terrorist group. The bullet doesn't kill him, but its radioactive coating, for now just go with it, does poison him. With the clock ticking, his wife, played by Rebecca Hall and a scientist skilled in AI herself, uses a technology developed by a colleague to transfer her husband's consciousness into a computer and thence onto the web. The question, of course, as the couple's colleague, played by Paul Bettany, puts it, is what exactly is now wending its way down the information highway? When Caster begins expressing an unnatural interest in financial systems and subsequently orchestrates a significant boost to his wife's bank account, the better for them to flee to the desert, where they eventually build a formidable solar-powered subterranean installation, it's no small issue. And when Caster uses his newly boosted intellect to invent a nanotechnology that can cure the disabled and, by the way, also introduce brain implants for convenient remote control, it not surprisingly raises concerns among Caster's colleagues, including Morgan Freeman, the terrorists headed up by Kate Mara, and the feds, represented by Cillian Murphy. And all this would be prime material for a good, creepy science fiction tale that could also delve a bit into the issues of what makes us human and how far does the illusion of humanity have to go before it becomes actual humanity. To his credit, director Wally Pfister, who previously has worked primarily with Christopher Nolan as his director of photography and is making his directorial debut here, works no little ominous ambience into the central section of the film, where we watch Will build his solar-powered miracle facility and observe his wife's growing doubt about his intent. And reflecting perhaps the influence of Chris Nolan, who's credited as executive producer here, Pfister works to keep a grounded sense to the story, favoring genuine locations over CG sets and making the film as much a love story as a techno-thriller. But there are problems. Grounding the science fiction may be intended to keep things credible, but it also flattens out the tone overall. Johnny Depp has, ironically for this actor, been directed to deliver an overly restrained performance, which may be intended to instill ambiguity to Caster once he's just an image on a video screen, but gives us very little personality to hang on to before the transition, and pushes perceptions of the character's actions too far to the ominous afterwards, when the story could have been better served if just a little more doubt was in play. And the script, written by Jack Paglen, indulges in so many leaps of logic and plotting conveniences, including attempting to orchestrate empathy for terrorists previously seen murdering an entire roomful of innocent people with poison, that the story's credibility crumbles even as you're watching it. I can't dismiss the effort put into Transcendence. In many ways, it feels like a 70s film updated to the technology and concerns of the 21st century. And that's not a bad thing. But on the key requirements of building a believable story and making us care what happens to its participants, it's a significant failure. I'm Dan Persons. Remember, you can now access our archive of Hour of the Wolf movie reviews over at Cinefantastique Online. Catch up on what you missed by going to cfqonline.com.
And once again, good morning. This is a pre-recorded show, actually recorded a scant few hours before we go into broadcast. But between me being a little under the weather and the weather being over most of us, it made sense to pre-record, since most of the program is already on digital recording, and do it thusly. This week we are actually going to hear two reviews by Dan Persons, because since our needful preemption of last week, due to the great loss of Robert Knight, Dan had recorded a review, but we did not get to air it. We will hear that after the interview that you're about to hear. And this was recorded about a month ago in Brooklyn, and the person in question is Nalo Hopkinson, one of the top writers in fantasy more than science fiction, although which it is debatable and almost not important. She is also one of the top black writers in the genre, but I don't separate it out. She's merely great and a wonderful person. And without any further ado, let's listen. It's 4 o'clock in the afternoon on a Friday in Brooklyn.
Yes.
And of the year 14.
Yes.
And it is March, still March, right?
Still March, just barely.
March 28th. Yeah. Right, okay. So, I am with one of my favorite writers and people, two different things, Nalo Hopkinson. And when we figured out the last time I saw you was when you were the guest of honor at ReaderCon,
mm-hmm.
and I had the thrill of being, instead of doing just a speech, they do two things. They do an analysis of a writer's work,
mm-hmm.
which this critic from the West Coast, Gary Wolf.
He's from Chicago.
Oh, he's from Chicago. Okay. Mm-hmm. Gary Wolf did a splendid job on.
Mm-hmm.
And then right after that, I had the honor of interviewing
that
you.
That was fun.
As it was very well attended. And
you researched everything.
No.
No, it sure seemed like it.
No, I know your work.
Apologies.
I do my research piecemeal.
Yes.
I read what you write. and that was also probably, what, like my fifth interview with
yeah.
you? Not
yeah.
counting the times that I follow you around, what was it, Tree of Life books in Harlem?
Oh, probably, yes. The years... Things fade.
Yeah. Well, this was a horribly memorable one because you were going to be touring with Octavia
mm-hmm.
Butler,
mm-hmm.
and she had died,
mm-hmm.
Oh, I think this was in the summer, and she had died in the spring before.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's right.
And it was to have been a two-person tour, mm-hmm. and instead it became both you had...
Mm-hmm. That in the memorial to Octavia.
Yeah, well, it was a combination of promoting. Now, here I have to look just to get the titles. Which book did you just have out at that
point?
That
probably would have been New Moon's Arms.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, it was New Moon's Arms.
And Octavia had just had the paperback of Fledgling, I think.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, the trade paperback.
Yes, yeah.
And the two of you are going to be
touring
together, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. instead turned into a combination of New Moon's Arms and the tribute.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the recording of that did not come out perfectly, but it was a very memorable...
Hmm.
Good event, and I love the bookstore, which, alas, is no longer there.
Yes, yes, yes.
And I haven't told you. Would you believe me if I told you that WBAI is now located near there?
I'd believe you.
We're,
New York's like
we're,
that.
We're in. Well, we had a wonderful space that you were at.
Yes.
Did I record you when you were? No. I forced you there. You were there. At 5 in the morning.
Oh, God, at least twice.
Well, you're first at the church.
Okay.
You used to own a church.
I just remember it was, oh, God, 1:00 in the morning.
Yes. So I used to make you get up at mm-hmm. unpardonable hours, although I have to say I love that time of day.
Oh.
It's a magic. I know it's difficult.
Huh.
It's actually easier for people to do my current time slot,
mm-hmm.
but... It's harder for listeners.
Mm-hmm, mm, yeah, I understand. But with fibromyalgia, the disturbed sleep was brutal.
Yeah. But there's also... But I dare say that I've had you on the radio since the beginning of your writing career.
Yes, yeah.
Since Brown Girl in the Ring mm-hmm. won the John W. Campbell Award for Best New Writer.
Mm-hmm.
Or no, it wasn't... It wasn't it. It was you who won the award. It wasn't the book.
It wasn't the book. It was me. I won the Locus First Novel Award for that book.
That's right.
Yeah.
And it was a wonderful book and a highly recognized book. And this is, I think, just before, I think, the book that broke the barrier.
Mm-hmm. Which one was that?
Jesus, Dark Matter.
Yes. Cherie Thomas.
Cherie Renee Thomas.
Yeah.
I think that's the book that, for me,
yeah.
broke the barrier. But I think it broke the barrier for a lot of black writers as well.
Yeah.
Because I think it said, you can do this.
We're here. Yeah.
We're here. And what's one of the barriers it broke for me is that I used to be able to say when I had like Delaney on or Octavia or something, I'm saying... I could name, you know, the number of black science fiction writers on
one hand,
maybe two, because I was familiar with a few one-shot writers that were in Analog or Galaxy or something like that, but just didn't make it a career.
Yes.
So I could do two hands.
Yes.
And Octavia and Chip.
Yeah.
Who both taught this stuff.
Yes.
Agreed.
Yes.
And along comes Cherie Renee Thomas.
Yes. And does a compendium dating back to,
To the late 19th century,
mm-hmm.
but, including a story of undeniable speculative fiction
mm-hmm.
by Dubois,
mm-hmm. yes.
and finding a couple of stories that I think the writers would have been horrified to hear them called science fiction, but out of the Harlem Renaissance.
Yes. Yeah, for sure.
But what they are simply is, you know, surreal fiction of the 20s and 30s.
Yes.
And it's like, guess what? This stuff has been here all along.
Yeah.
Now what we need to do is codify it, bring people in.
Yeah.
And I'm doing all the talking. In the 70s, the early 70s, late 60s, early 70s, the women's barrier was broken.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And women could now become, instead of UK Le Guin,
mm-hmm.
Ursula K. Le Guin. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, Ursula. I know you defend that. Mm-hmm. But was Playboy magazine and you published that as UK Le Guin. So,
or they made her publish it as UK Le Guin.
She didn't know until the, yeah. It's like our, I think she was just told our readership will find it easier. Although they had a picture of her in the magazine. They weren't disguising the fact. But in the table of contents.
This is UK Le Guin. It's hilarious.
Yeah. C.L. Moore, all these, you know, two-lettered people.
Yeah. I think there's a danger, though, in saying that the barrier is broken, that it leads to people thinking that there's no more a problem. So, now that, you know, you and I can both name black writers on more than the fingers of two hands.
Thank God.
Yes. Still doesn't mean...
And young ones.
Yes. Still doesn't mean there isn't a barrier or a problem or a difficulty or that writers of color are getting published in the mainstream at acceptable levels. It's still a problem.
Well, science fiction isn't the mainstream. And it should be. In the foreground. It should
it's
be in the avant-garde.
It's my mainstream.
Well, yes. It's what you do. And yet, mm-hmm. one could make an argument. The way books are sold today, mm-hmm. I mean, YA novels are not necessarily termed fantasy or science fiction, and yet almost all of them, Chris Barzak's fiction, mm-hmm. People are aware of the fact that it is gay. Well, they use the word queer, but I've always had a problem with that word. It's a generational thing.
Yep, it's my preferred word for me. But yes, I understand the generational thing.
Yeah, well, you see, you didn't grow up in Queens.
No.
Where this word could be nothing but derogatory.
Yeah, I did
and
not.
Where it was a call for violence.
Yep. I did not, yeah.
And if you were in a high school or junior high at mm-hmm, the time and mm-hmm. you heard that term, mm-hmm. it was used by people who were giggling at the harm they were going to cause another
yes,
human being.
I do know this.
And this is in my growing up DNA.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I have friends for whom that was very much a reality.
And so when Sam Miller holds his queer readings at Blue Stocking Books, I shiver. I use it. And he had a wonderful thing to say to me.
Yeah.
He said, "Thank you, Jim, for using the term outside of your comfort zone."
Yes.
That is exactly right.
Yeah.
You know, he got it.
Yeah.
He understood my problem.
Yeah, I get it.
With
the term.
Yeah.
Yeah, I get it.
You know, it's like, I just had a big meal. I feel queer. Come on.
So many thoughts.
You know, it's, I like the term gay. It's a happy word. But hey, I just turned 3 score years old.
Ha-ha.
So I think it's...
I'm not too far behind you.
You are 7 years and 10 days older
than
me.
Oh my God, yes!
Okay, I do some of my research. Your birthday is December 20th, 1960. May I say that on the air?
Yes, you absolutely may.
And I'm 1953, December 30th.
Oh, okay.
And having just hit that landmark birthday, and it was horrible until the day after.
Oh, okay.
The day after?
The day after?
I had turned.
Yeah.
I had turned. Yeah. I was no longer about to become 60.
Yes.
And somebody else, and I think it was the aforementioned Mr. Bose,
yes,
who said to me something like, 60 is the new... 45.
Yeah.
60 is no longer old. When I was growing up, 60 was old, and it wasn't just looking at that far in the future.
Yeah.
Is that life expectancies, health issues like that are different, mm-hmm. more manageable.
Mm-hmm. Very much so.
And while I'm losing my hair, outside of that, I'm very vain about my hair. I had gorgeous hair, but I had a jufro.
Oh. You
know, I had a big, you know.
Yeah. And curl,
red,
you told me.
Red, red,
nice.
Curly.
Very nice.
Big hippie.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hairstyle.
Very
you know,
nice.
Or non-style. Anyway. and then I saw a picture of myself and I saw the crown of my head and there wasn't any hair there. Mm. And I was like, ooh.
Oh,
ow.
Yeah, that would be hard.
That one, the turning 60, I'll cope with.
Yeah.
The being bald on top.
Yeah. Yeah, I get it.
It's an issue.
It is an issue.
But the last time I saw you, getting back on track here, because we've just been having a wonderful time for 90 minutes or 2 hours or so with a lovely lunch and just catching up.
Yeah.
And you look so good.
Thank you. Thank you. I, like I said, having a regular income does wonders for you.
Well, the last time I saw you, I am... this is horrible. Almost proud to say that I brought you to tears.
Practically
to tears.
We can
hear the recording. It was the guest of honor speech at ReaderCon, and what I did was the old James Lipton. I hate his style,
yeah.
But it works when you're trying to honor a career.
Yes.
And you say, first you did this. First this brown girl in the ring. Then there's Midnight Robber. Then there's I'm not looking at anything, people. And so on and so forth.
Yeah.
I more or less knew my stuff, but I also knew that your life was not representative of what this exceedingly accomplished avant-garde yet mainstream writer in the future. You're a mainstream writer. I don't think that you're a genre writer at all. And yet what you write is happily genre.
Oh, I'm definitely a genre person for sure.
Yeah,
that's where most of my reading happens. It's
But also at that point, now we're talking that we fade was 2009.
By then I was beginning to come out of it.
You were. Mm-hmm. You said at that point there was a happy ending to that.
Mm-hmm.
It was not I am homeless now.
No.
You had just gotten out of that situation
in a friend's apartment. So yes.
And you were starting to write The New Moon's Arms at that point, I think. No, or
I've
are you...
Out already. I was working on The Chaos and on What Would Become Sister Mine.
You were working on Sister Mine already.
Yeah.
Okay, and Sister Mine, by the way, is the new book, we should tell everybody, out from Grand Central Publishing.
Yes.
Once known as Hachette, once known as...
Warner, once known as Time Warner, known as Warner Aspect, at least. For the science fiction side.
Yeah. Yes, once known as Betsy Mitchell.
Yes.
Once known as, and there is a name, by the way, who has done a lot.
Yeah.
A lot in bringing people of color into, and she continues to do that at Open Road Media.
When she phoned me, when she was the head of Warner Aspect, and she phoned me in Toronto from New York to tell me that I had won the contest, she said, can I ask you something? I said, yes.
Just 1 second. Making sure we're recording. We are. Sorry, go on.
this woman has just told me I've won this contest.
This is a major contest.
Yeah,
this
1,500 people. She figured that's how many applications they got. She said, can I ask you something? I said, yes. She said, are you black? I said, yes. She said, oh, good.
Such a wonderful story.
And we were off to the races.
Yeah, but you were off to the races regardless, but she was just that much happier.
Yes, she was.
That, yes, I have done a mitzvah.
Yes.
Is a good word.
Yes.
I am on the political road that I have set.
Yes. And what I love about Betsy is that she does not mince words, so she just asked me.
Yeah.
And I much prefer that. I don't have to guess at what you're trying to say. With Betsy, I know what she's trying to say.
Yeah, no, and she chooses well. She's a good acquisitions person.
And a good editor.
Yeah. And and they're growing. John Douglas, who's a friend of mine, just joined at Open Road.
Mm-hmm,
and they're very interesting because they are not a traditional publisher.
They're doing good work.
They really are. Yeah. They really are. Yeah. And they're still sort of like under... the spotlight, yeah. even though I think it'll come out full-blown,
yes.
what they were doing.
Yes.
But Sister Mine is the new book.
Uh-huh.
From, who's the editor there now?
Lindsay. I cannot remember her surname. I'm having a day like that, so now I'm apologizing to Lindsay, my new and wonderful editor.
Who acquired Sister Mine?
No, Jamie acquired it.
Okay.
And Lindsay took it over from her. I've been lucky. I've twice been orphaned, but both times the outgoing person has trained
the incoming person bought
on
into
my work. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because I've known too many people where a novel.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody said, oh, this is going to be a wonderful trilogy. Book one comes out, mm-hmm. a new editor comes in. Mm-hmm. They don't even necessarily want book two,
mm-hmm.
even though book one may have sold
it. Or they do no editing on book one, so it doesn't, not much promotion, so it doesn't, much see the light of day. I've seen that happen to friends. I have been very lucky.
But Grand Central also has that rarest of things, a mm-hmm. publicist
yes.
who concentrates on multicultural...
Linda Duggins.
Yes, who I mean...
Amazing woman.
She really is. I mean, I've come to know the writers of Warner Aspect, mm-hmm. and it's the opposite of antecedents, it's procedents.
Precedents?
The imprints that followed.
Yes. Lindsay Rose.
Ah, there we go.
Yeah.
Who has brought me people like Octavia Butler literally to my house. And you came to my house.
I did.
As well.
I did, yes. I remember.
And I've only done about 5 or 6 interviews there, but
yeah.
they've been good ones.
Yes.
And, Sister Mine, I think, is a special book in many
Thank
ways.
You.
Many of your works are, but I don't know what it is. I almost... People label it YA.
Mm-hmm.
It's sold as young adult.
Sister Mine, no.
It isn't?
It's sold as adult.
It is sold as adult.
It's up for the Norton Award, so the YA award that's given during the Nebulas. I'm
right.
not really sure why, with all the sort of...
Yeah, well, it uses that typeface that I have come to, although I consider it a comfortable
yes.
typeface.
Yes.
I can see it. A large font. Let's see. I've got the publicity right here. And, they say award-winning GCP. Oh, Grand Central Press. I was reading this and trying to figure out, gee, what category of a person is GCP? Great colored person?
No.
Took me a little while to figure that one out. No, it actually doesn't.
It's adult, yeah. It's adult. So
it is, and yet, I bet that it could be. When you think about...
People tend to get stuck at the lesbian incest that's happening in Sister Mine. So I can't see that easily becoming YA.
The incest part is problem. The lesbian part, I mentioned Chris
Barzak
before.
No,
there is so much gay fiction.
The queer part, not at all. But I put the two together, right? Because it's two sisters. So people tend to get...
More than sisters.
People tend to get stuck at that, even though anything I describe sort of off-scene.
Yeah.
So I can't see it easily being YA.
Hmm. Well, I'm shocked at what is YA. But but it's just a marketing term.
Yeah, yeah.
And now there's a new word.
Yes.
New adult fiction. Have you heard about this one? A new thing that they're trying to sell books as? You're not a young adult, you're a new adult.
Okay, so it's still the young adult, but...
There's still YA, but YA sort of like ends at 18 years old.
Okay.
So what do we have for 18 to 25?
Adult.
Yeah, but I mean, yeah. I don't even like YA. I used to read juveniles.
I read anything As long as it's got some kind of element of fantasy.
And I love juveniles. Mm-hmm. I still love juveniles.
Yes.
And YA. In
some
fact,
more,
YA for me means comfort zone book.
Yeah, some of the more sort of meaty fiction happening there.
Yeah. And I understand that there's a way of saying family approval, and don't be shocked when you discover that the book, I love to keep naming Chris Barzak because I know I've had him on the show, and he's got a movie coming out.
Does he?
He does. It was shown at Sundance.
Excellent.
I don't know if anybody picked it up for distribution, but it's been made.
I haven't seen Chris in years, but I emailed with him when I discovered he'd been mugged here in New York.
Oh.
And had fought this mugger off by beating him about the head with his cell phone that the guy was trying to steal.
Yeah, well, it wasn't trying to steal, he stole it, and I'm sorry, but as a New Yorker, may I just say that if you're downtown, west of the Christopher Street area, on the west by the West Side Highway, which is a known cruising zone and known gay bashing zone.
Yeah.
Okay, and that's where the Q word comes, and let's go roll some queers.
Yeah.
That's where people go to do it. And you stand there as an out-of-towner using your brand-new iPhone 5.
The guy didn't get
I
the
love
phone.
Chris.
The guy did not get the phone.
He didn't get the phone, but no, but Chris got the hospital. Mm-hmm. Chris got beaten.
Mm-hmm.
And all I can say as a hardened New Yorker is people from Ohio should be given manuals when you come here, okay?
I just love, he's my new hero, because first of all, how do you hit somebody with a cell phone? Things don't have handles. But that his response was to get angry and fight back. Oh, my new hero.
And he's actually fit.
Yeah. He said he didn't.
He's also a sweetie.
He's a darling and a brilliant writer, and he can fight back. Do not mess with Mr. Barzak.
Yes.
Love him.
Yeah. And he, and his godfather is Richard Bowes.
Oh, all right.
Of all the this incestuous little group we have here in New York, which is how I heard certain details of the story.
Yeah.
Rick and I were just one day sort of like hanging our heads saying, no, West Side, no.
Yeah. But nobody tells you that. So, I mean, I show up here and I don't know what I can do where. So,
You have friends.
I have friends. I do have friends. I just don't know if I'd be able to fight back the way Chris did. I hope so. Yeah. I like to think so.
Yeah. But it's just a deserted part of New York. Mm. You know, I mean, deserted.
Mm-hmm.
When you're in an area in a city you don't know well, mm-hmm. and there is nobody else around you. Mm-hmm. I mean, I found myself once in the South Side of Chicago, mm-hmm. and I didn't know where I was.
Mm-hmm.
And I just knew, get into a bar, call the cab.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Hmm.
And the bar wasn't that friendly, you know.
Yeah. Like,
you know. But then again, I'm an urban guy.
Yes.
I'm from New York.
Yes.
One syllable.
Yes.
This is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio broadcasting at 99.5 FM. My name is Jim Freund, and you are listening to an interview with Nalo Hopkinson. Her first name is N-A-L-O, if you'd like to Google her up or find her blog or something. And we will now return to the interview.
Sister Mine is a fascinating book. There are a lot of people, I'm going to mention it again, Bowes, N.K. Jemisin,
mm-hmm.
Eliodon Johnson,
mm-hmm.
Karen Lord,
mm-hmm.
people who are using a mythology, a place from within themselves. Some of it may come from a real mythology,
mm-hmm.
but most of it is very original. In so many ways, and I would never like to apply the term magical realism. It's not.
Mm-hmm.
These are about gods.
Mm-hmm.
every one of the books I mentioned, mm-hmm. or the writers I mentioned, have used gods mm-hmm. as characters mm-hmm. in their book. Or it's demigod.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Although, yeah, yeah. the god of death, is well, he a demigod?
He's an Orisha, like the rest of them. He's an Orisha.
Uh-huh.
Or a Loa. So, yes. He's the god of or deity or demigod or whatever. He's the Orisha of death and life. So he's really the mm-hmm. Orisha of the crossroads between the two. So
yeah.
he ferries you not just from life to death, but also from the other world to life. So children are as beloved to him as older people. They're both about to cross.
All your gods have two aspects.
I realized that somewhere near the end when I was fishing for an ending.
So we shouldn't talk too much about that.
I don't know. That's okay.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Because that's the thing that I love is that as the book is over, there yeah. is a promise of discovery.
Yes. Yes.
And I love that.
I'm glad you do.
I love that the book lives on in my head.
That's good.
In that way.
Yeah.
No sequel, please. It's
no.
Everybody will have their own sequel. Everybody will have their own idea.
Yes. I like to end things like that. Some people really hate it when I do it because they want me to sort of tie up all of the story. And I like it when we leave the character at the point of change and their life has just opened up. And so they could now do... You don't know what they'll do next.
But that's the happy ending,
yes,
isn't it?
That they have possibilities.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That they were confined,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and now have found a freedom
yes.
that has never been afforded them before.
Yes,
and this is something. It's interesting to note, and there's a bit of that in Barzac as well.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting to note that every writer that I've mentioned, while not necessarily a person of color.
Mm-hmm.
is a person who is outside the mainstream of society, of American society.
Okay. That is interesting.
And that the happy ending is things are going to change.
Yes.
And that, in its way, is enough.
It's the only ending that
because
this is me.
Yeah, well, yes, because it's not about what happens to the character
yeah.
in the book.
Yeah.
It's about what happens to the person who's reading the book.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
And therein comes our lesson.
Mm-hmm.
What was different earlier in Left Hand of Darkness, which mm-hmm. broke so many barriers?
Mm-hmm.
That's a book with closure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the closure is a lesson learned
mm-hmm.
and all that.
Mm-hmm.
But Dahlgren is cyclical.
Yes.
There's no explaining Dahlgren without having a 10-hour introduction.
Well, it's like taking a slinky, twisting it, and then joining both ends.
Yeah. To wound the autumnal city.
Yes.
For I have come to, I love that. It is a cycle.
Yes.
It is literally a cycle,
yes.
more so than so many things that are called cycles.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
The Female Man
yes.
by Joanna Russ
yes.
has a certain closure
yeah.
to it, and yet not, although my preferred work of her is When It Changed.
Mm-hmm.
And that promises
mm-hmm.
actually a dark future,
mm-hmm.
but it also ends at that moment.
Yeah.
Your short stories, though, have different structures.
Do they?
I think some of them do.
I think it's changing, so I can't quite tell what I have right now. Different how?
I think that there's more. Not finality,
uh-huh.
not closure
yeah.
in them. But I think I have a better idea of what's happened and is about to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And I will continue thinking about them when they are over, but more for their content
mm-hmm.
rather than for what's next.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think it's it's easier to do that sort of openness of ending with a novel.
Really?
Because you can, you can build up the possibilities. With a short story, it is more of a, it's a more of a brief trajectory. Mm-hmm. Whereas novels kind of, they're like sort of entering open water. A short story is more like getting from one place to the next.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. One of my, how do I put it? One of my favorite writers of short stories. It's also the woman with whom I live.
Yeah.
I'm, pardon me. She does something very interesting in her short stories. And she's published 21 or so, so it's fair to discuss Barbara Krasnov's writing, although it's never, there's no book or anything, but it's a lot of good, she's published in a lot of good places. And her stories very often end at the moment of revelation.
Oh, that's hard to do.
And that's actually, sometimes her stories have been rejected.
Yeah.
By at least one major editor said, now that I know what this story is about, why is it over?
That's when it needs to be over.
That's what I think, because what it's doing is, for me, is those stories have, and this is true of Sister Mine.
Yeah.
Sister Mine has a closure of a kind.
Yes.
But it also leaves you with a trajectory.
Yes.
As does Barbara Krasnov's stories, after you have gotten that moment, you're still out there spinning with it and going, oh my, if that... That is what happened, and therefore, and it continues internally.
Mm-hmm. There's also the fact that once you have that bit, once you have, say, a happy ending, then you've probably already overstayed your welcome, right? Because the story, fiction is about strife, it's about problems.
Mm-hmm.
If everything's working out fine, then all you're doing is wrapping up, and I get bored. It's like, all right, so okay, so we know Ryan, she finds a job, we know he meets his lover, whatever. What am I doing here in this story anymore? It's not a story anymore. It's just tying knots, right?
Yeah.
Or tying terminal knots, rather.
Yeah, and part of my problem with some people's writing is, when they do that, they become didactic.
Mm-hmm.
It's, let me teach you a lesson.
And the moral of this
one. And the moral of this one is that politically you have to be A, or maybe you have to be B, or something, and this is the reason for it. And, ah, now I understand. Mm-hmm. You were right all along, and I was wrong, and I'm going to continue my life.
Yeah. No, yes, so not interesting. People are contrary.
Even when I agree with what that person has to say.
Yes.
I do not like to be, I was going to say didactic to. you know, I'm going to why one book of a Bible is preferable to me than another book of the Bible. I prefer Parable of the Sowers over Parable of the Talents because there were new worlds to discover in Parable of the Sowers, and while Parable of the Talents was going somewhere really good, it also was reiterating something that I had already learned in the first book.
I thought she was feeling for it and then creating the platform from which the next one would forward.
Well, that no, let's not go there.
No, let's that's not, or we'll be both weeping.
it's simply one of the great tragedies of the world that Octavia Butler had a 10-year writer's block.
Yeah.
And it broke with Fledgling.
Yes.
Which was, she had...
Her fun book.
Yes!
That's what she called it, pretty much.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. She had to turn a corner and stop beating her head on, I've got a MacArthur grant, I've got to make the next book a piece of world literature, and the expectations of her were so strong, so she wrote a fun book.
Yeah, I love it.
And then... And in that the last interview that I did with her, mm-hmm. about 3 months before the tragedy, mm-hmm. she said, well, now that the writing block is over, I have got a place where I am going to go, and I know how I'm going to do it. And it's like, oh.
Well, it's sort of like an open-ended story. We get to imagine what that might have been.
It is, and I just pray that nobody else... You know, 25 years from now or something, when the rights are murky.
Decides to try and finish. Oh, God, that's always a nightmare.
It happens all the time.
Don't do it. People just don't finish.
Not that Asimov is in the same league, mm-hmm. But he's a different era. But how many people have written the robot books, the Foundation books? Mm-hmm. Oh, what he really meant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he did it to himself.
Yeah, well, he gets to do it to himself.
Yes, he did. He tied together the Foundation books and the robot books, where it turns out that one wonderful character, Harry Seldon, was really Ardiel Olivaw in the robot. And it's like, no, Ike, you just ruined both series of books for me.
I
and you've done it yourself.
That part out.
Yeah, I did him the honor of not continuing not to read his stuff after that, and ignoring the David Brin books. David Brin continued the series. Oh yes, at least three.
Don't do that.
And he's a good writer.
He is a good writer, but don't do that. It's sort of when you do that, it has to be your vision. So it's no longer. It's no longer whatever book that you it's no longer Tolkien if you're trying to finish a Tolkien book. It's no longer
how many Christopher Tolkien wrote more Tolkien than John Tolkien.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. Just don't do it. Write your work.
And the Silmarillion was never intended to be published. And God knows it was not intended to be made into a movie, but that's Let's stay away from that. A nice 90-minute version of The Hobbit would have suited me just fine, thank you. But anyway, speaking of that,
yes,
there is nothing in most of your writing, and especially with Sister Mine, that isn't cinematically possible.
Really?
Yes.
It's not what the cinema world's telling me, but okay.
I'm sorry, whom?
Just people have optioned my work.
Yeah.
And I think then the problem is raising the funds for it. Because you go to someplace else and they see black science fiction or black fantasy, and people get told dumb things like black people don't watch science fiction and fantasy.
Oh, yeah, right.
Or so there's too many special effects. It would be too expensive to make.
Well, you see, that's... Yes, but there have been things... Mm-hmm. that have proven the lie to that. I mean, as much as I cannot watch Game of Thrones because I have a weak stomach for gore,
mm-hmm.
And I like George Martin's writing a great deal, but I do not read those books.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I will do him the honor of not reading those books, and I don't watch his TV show. I'll read his other books.
I've watched bits of it, and I read the first Game of Thrones and quite liked it. But I was reading at a point where I had very little brain for an extended series.
Yeah, I stopped the TV series when I saw, the spear go through somebody's eye and come out the back of their head.
Yeah, I look away in those moments.
I try to, but they purposely try to surprise you.
Uh-huh.
And for me, that's not entertainment.
No.
My having... horrible, squeamy visions. I have no problem saying to the audience, I'm squeamish.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
I don't like that. I can deal... It's not a question of violence, it's a question of gore.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not too good with it either. I can deal with a certain amount.
But few things have proven out. Game of Thrones mm-hmm. is one of the biggest hits television has ever had, and mm-hmm. who would have thunk it? Mm-hmm. And certain movies, some of which have even been flops, like John Carter, mm-hmm. which should have been John Carter of Mars, mm-hmm. which was an amazing-looking, seamless-appearing movie mm-hmm. of a 100-year-old... Mm-hmm. And thank God, modernized mm-hmm. by Michael Chabon, mm-hmm. science fiction. Mm-hmm. We do mm-hmm. not want to see Edgar mm-hmm. Rice Burroughs'
nope.
version.
Even just the title put me off.
A Princess of Mars?
No, I mean just that they were that it was going to be John Carter of Mars, and I thought, do I want to be this offended?
Yeah, but it's Michael Chabon who wrote it.
I did not know that.
You see, that's. Yeah. That's the difference. And the person who made the movie, mm-hmm. his previous film was Wall-E.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Still, people surprise you.
No,
it's not pleasantly.
I liked it. I don't think it was a great movie. Mm. But I thought that it took the technology mm-hmm. of Pixar.
Okay, so you're talking about...
the ability to make...
To make an expense, something that has a lot of special effects.
Yeah. Or sure. to cut down the expense. Mm-hmm. So people can do animated films for cheap. Mm-hmm.
Fonda's Moon in the Sun is being made into a full-length film.
Finally. Really?
Yes. Well, I remember talking to her soon after she'd written...
We're talking about Fonda McIntyre.
Yeah, Fonda McIntyre. And she was saying, well, it can't be made at this point because the special effects would be too expensive, and now the cost has come down.
Oh, that was true.
Yeah,
it was true. And I'm telling people, time for Lord of Light. Forget Argo. Argo, that awful movie that they were going to make that nobody would buy, so it was bought eventually by the CIA. And that story is a great story. But... Lord of Light is one of my favorite novels yes. of science fantasy. You don't know.
Yes.
First time you read it, it's a fantasy novel.
Yes.
The second time you read it, it's hard science
yes.
fiction.
Yes.
The third time, it's like the Ramayana. It's the time has come. And, I mean, Sister Mine, what's in there that couldn't be done on HBO? Or a different...
I never really think in those terms because I'm so used to the movie versions of a novel not being that good that I don't think in terms...
That's often the case.
Yeah.
But it's not always the case.
What surprised me when I first started to...
I saw a beautiful vampire film, can you imagine? Byzantium, directed by Neil Jordan.
Hmm. Okay. Yeah, it's not always the case. Something Wicked This Way Comes to me lives, the film and the book match. The film lives.
Well, I actually was written as a film first.
That, really?
Yes, Bradbury wrote a screenplay. It didn't sell, so he novelized it himself.
Imagine Bradbury and all that internal gloriousness of his language writing something as stripped down as a screenplay.
He wrote Moby Dick. He won the Academy Award for writing the screenplay for John Huston of Moby Dick. People forget that Bradbury wrote 5 or 6 movies. I mean, never mind It Conquered the World, which he wrote.
Yeah, but it's different. It's your
but own. He wrote Moby Dick.
It's your own.
Which actually is not something to totally boast about. It's a fun movie, but it's not Melville.
Yes, yes. However...
Although Orson Welles is the preacher. Nice job. But no, Bradbury was a professional screenwriter.
Wow, that's very cool. But yeah, so I don't think in terms of movies, and I was surprised when I first started being asked to do speaking engagements, that particularly talking to young people, their assumption was that I had written the book in order for it to be made into a movie. And that
Which is the way they tend to think today.
Yeah, that startled me. So I don't know if I try to think back on Sister Mine. It's still kind of a fog how I wrote it.
See. I wanted to actually get to that in a minute or so, but
yeah,
just when I read it, I saw it.
Yeah.
Actually, I heard it. I'm a radio person.
Yes,
heard it.
Well, I do write. I mean, Dad was a
Well, you're a radio actor. Person.
Yeah.
And your father.
So I write.
Very special man, your father.
The way things sound, I think so. I'm going to get to see Derek Walcott tonight, and my dad was in his theater company in Trinidad.
And I will never forget the time, the last time that I think I had you on the air live.
Mm-hmm.
There was this fellow, elderly fellow, and I saw him as recently as 2 months ago.
Yes.
Bernie. Mm-hmm. Bernie. One of the background people, one of the men people don't see,
mm-hmm.
if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Because off mic we were talking about the women men don't
mm-hmm,
see.
Mm-hmm.
He's one of the people that, you know, greets the volunteers
yes.
who come in and make sure that they get fed and that
mm-hmm.
they're treated like human beings and
yes,
all that.
Wonderful.
Very, very, what's the word? Oh, not quite regal, but, you know, man
he
of
has
poise.
Gravitas, yes.
Yes. He has gravitas and all that, but he's one of the people that the people on the air at BAI almost would never look at.
Mm-hmm.
And he purposely stays out of the way, and you're on the air.
Mm-hmm.
And he comes to the studio window next door, and he plasters his face staring into the room. Now, this is not like him.
Yes. He was like having the perfect audience.
Yeah, and I wish he'd just come into the room. But I'm like that. I'm very easy about that kind of a thing. And then when we got off the air, his eyes very wide, his voice in awe. I'm sorry, your father's full name was?
Slade Hopkinson.
That's how Slade Hopkinson.
Yeah.
He says, you are the daughter of Slade Hopkinson. Was not a question.
No.
And you were like a little, okay, do I have a stalker? You know, what is it? And he said, and I had no idea this gentleman was from Trinidad.
Oh,
I was as guilty as my brethren at the station at simply taking this wonderful man for granted.
Yes.
Although I took for granted the fact that he always brought, he knew that I liked a certain kind of bagel. And he always made sure that there was one put aside for me.
Yeah.
He studied lectures on Shakespeare that your father gave in Trinidad.
Yep. It was wonderful having a Shakespearean actor for a father when I had to study Shakespeare in school.
Yes, but also not from the culture that people tend to think. My father, who was a German-Jewish immigrant, learned English
mm-hmm.
by translating Shakespeare into German.
Ah.
And that's really bizarre because Shakespeare is not spoken English the way she is spoke
mm-hmm.
in America
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
in any way, shape, or form.
No. Mm-hmm.
And when I say America, I include your northern part, Canada,
mm-hmm. very true.
Which is part of America.
Yeah, whereas Shakespeare plays fairly well in the Caribbean.
I would think so.
A lot of the words are still used.
and a lot of the productions
mm-hmm.
are moved that way.
Mm-hmm.
There was just Julius Caesar
mm-hmm.
set in an unnamed island.
Mm-hmm. And there's a tradition of pantomime in the Caribbean going back centuries. So. Yeah, it that kind of plays quite well.
Yeah. But moving on back to that, and I'm so glad I saw Bert, but BAI had we now have offices
mm-hmm.
not far from here on Atlantic Avenue.
Mm-hmm.
Our studios are in a not great location.
Mm-hmm.
Not the location, the area, the neighborhood
mm-hmm.
in Harlem
mm-hmm.
is fine.
Mm-hmm.
But we're stuck in CCNY
mm-hmm.
renting one room from another radio station where
mm-hmm.
we are the trespassers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And
you're sharecropping.
That's the perfect, I'm going to use that. That's exactly it. We are. And our owners want to get rid of us
mm-hmm.
because we're the most valuable part of their franchise
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and they think they can solve their problems by selling us off
mm-hmm.
even though we may be, but not from their point of view, the most important
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
part of their franchise
mm-hmm.
but anyway, that's neither here nor there
mm-hmm.
We have offices now at 388 Atlantic Avenue, which is a beautiful building
mm-hmm.
In what used to be not a good neighborhood
mm-hmm.
And has risen into a lovely black neighborhood of wonderful artisans, and they have a the ground floor, they have a market.
Yeah, nice.
They have a green market and artisans market every Sunday, and it can be a performance space. And there's an apiary on the roof.
Ooh.
Or as I put it, putting the bee back into WBAI. If we survive, there will be a BAI renaissance.
Oh, that's wonderful.
But it's we are so close to doom within the next couple of months.
Yeah.
But anyway... why did... Oh, and we were... But at the last Atlantic Antic, which is this wonderful street fair that runs for about a mile up and down Atlantic Avenue, just about half a mile from where we are now, Bernie showed up and asked about you.
Oh, sweetheart.
And I just... I mean, I was hawking to the public, give a donation, take this, do that, be aware of our programming. And he came up and I just melted. He is a spirit.
Yeah.
He could be out of one of your books.
Yeah.
He really is.
Yeah.
And the story I told must be, what, 12 years old?
Yes, easily.
He looks as good.
Well, you know, don't crack and everything.
You know, he's just, you know, he's a spirit.
Yeah.
But, and I hope you're listening. But... So, a lot of what I read, I mean, I think, okay, you have to meet somebody?
I do.
Are you going there, or is that person coming
here? He's here.
Oh, he's here now?
Yeah.
Is there any reason he can't come into this room?
None at all. I'll just tell him to come up.
Yeah. This is your agent.
This is my agent.
And if your agent doesn't mind the fact that we're, you know, pushing your books on the radio and stuff, and
I have a feeling he won't mind.
I have a feeling he won't mind, and we'll take. How long do you want to go? I'll take 5 hours, but if you need
I want to get to Derek's thing at 6:30.
Yes, you're in town for.
I'm in town for the National Black Writers Conference. I'm on a panel tomorrow morning with Tanana Review and Victor Valet, I think, on science fiction and fantasy for black communities.
And sadly, this panel has not been promoted through the science fiction community. Through the black community,
yes. But I think in order... Yeah, sometimes the lines don't always cross. I mean, it took me a while to...
I believe in inclusion.
If you depend on me to get the word out about something, you could be disappointed because sometimes I'm just too overwhelmed.
Yeah, but you know, simply the fact that this panel is there.
Yeah.
And I mean, the turnout, by the way, for the event at the Brooklyn Museum on Octavia Butler, there are 150 people there.
Yeah, they did a lot of promotion. I was seeing stuff just... You know, in California, stuff.
And it was a wonderful event, and my recording of it did not come out.
Oh.
So, now I'm happy because I mentioned that space in Atlantic Avenue.
Yes,
I'm going to get them women.
Yes,
over to that space, which doesn't have a proper studio, but that's okay.
Yeah.
I have a mic that will allow everybody to sit around a table and replicate what they said. And I provided the audio of Octavia from from WBAI, the audio that they used because they said it was in conversation with. And that and those were recordings that I had collected.
Yes,
some of which were from my show.
Yeah, that's nice.
So, I was very lucky.
Yeah.
Thank you. I'm pleased.
Yep.
So we're going to replicate that. And they did they were scheduled for like an hour.
Uh-huh.
They did 2.5. And they could have gone another. And they did not lose a person. And while you're texting your agent,
I just realized I need a key to get him up here.
Oh dear. Okay, so we can interrupt the recording.
Yeah.
But I will quickly just tell the story of how, as we're sitting in the Brooklyn Museum, Chris Claremont and Beth Fleischer were crossing the room, going through, following a curator who was taking them through an exhibit of Egyptian stuff. And I said, Chris, Beth, there are seats for you right here. And they sat down.
Nice. That's very
choice
nice.
Between the Egyptology
yes.
or a discussion Octavia Butler. They knew. You gotta give these folk credit, right? Okay.
This is Hour of the Wolf over WBAI in New York City, Pacifica Radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM. And you are two-thirds of the way through an interview with Nalo Hopkinson. And why wait? Let's go for the last part.
So we have been just like catching up and gabbling happily because you're one of the best people in the world with whom to do that. But we also need to let people know. We've talked around Sister Mine, mm-hmm. and we've made references to the gods and the forces within. And
yeah, and I should say that they aren't mostly my own imagination. They come from an established pantheon.
So let us, and pantheon, which I was aware of, but I'm not familiar with.
And I have messed with it, to be fair. I have messed with it a fair bit, but people will who know the Orishas will recognize which ones I'm talking about.
Well, tell us what it is. I asked Karen Lord that question, and, you know, 2 hours later, I'm
exactly.
just in awe.
Some of the religious systems that made it across the Atlantic during the slave trade from West Africa then got spread out throughout the Caribbean and have each their own sort of iterations. But you can trace them back to West Africa. They are very similar belief systems and similar deities in them all. The notion is that there is one God, but he's busy. He's constantly in the act of creating and destroying simultaneously. He's the engine. So he delegates. And the beings to whom he is delegated are this pantheon of Orishas.
I notice that shares something a little bit like Brahma.
It does, doesn't it? Yeah, which wouldn't surprise me, the Caribbean being sort of where everybody ended up at one point or the other. And so
everybody eats curry.
Exactly. And
fish.
So it ends up feeling a bit like the stories of the Greek gods, because they interact, they're quarrelsome, they fight, they make up, they get involved in the business of the affairs of this earth. One of the ways that happens in a worship service, because I'm talking a living religion here, so it's different than dealing with a religion that's passed into myth. This is a one that people actually practice. So in a ceremony, in what would be the equivalent of a church service, part of what you're doing there is you are opening yourself to the divine, and you're giving permission to the deities to temporarily house themselves in your consciousness, and that's how they get to interact with their parishioners on earth. You can call it possession, but it's not possession in the way of, you know, a demon possessing you. It's a god, and it's a consensual thing, and people who are wearing one of the deities on their heads, that's the term, during the service, can sometimes do things they aren't physically capable of, just as themselves. So that's the belief system that I draw on a lot, in large part because it comes from where I come from. The gods look like me.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a
like in Midnight Robber.
Yeah, there's a if not familiarity, because I didn't grow up with it, but there's a comfort there. And in Sister Mine, I've also added in a Trinidadian being who could be part of the pantheon, may not be. He could be the equivalent of, I think, Oshosi. He's called Papa Bois, Father of the Forest, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And I have him living in
he's a Nalotian.
I have him living in Toronto, Canada, because he's got himself...
Because he's an Aleutian.
He's got himself trapped in a human body for reasons that become clear, and he's raising his two daughters there. But he's developed Alzheimer's, so he's in a care home. The Lord of the Forest, the Trinidadian Forest, is in a care home in Toronto. He then goes missing, and his daughters have to find him. They have been raised by him and by his brother, who just happens to be death or life, depending on, you know, mm-hmm. who you're talking to at any given moment. So their uncle is the guardian of the crossroads between life and death, both ways.
Mm-hmm.
The girls are... They're not girls, they're in their 20s. They were born conjoined, separated at birth. And when they were separated, as happens with conjoined twins, they get different attributes. So my protagonist's sister was the one who got the magic. She did not. So the relationship between them is a little bit strained. And they have to go find their father. When they're not really having too much fun being sisters.
And one has real mojo, but they all have twins mojo.
They all have... How so?
They relate to each other very, very strongly in the way that ordinary sisters might not. And this is a common belief about twins, that they have these attributes.
They do relate to each other very strongly. When they were younger and my protagonist's sister, it took her a little bit... She wasn't quite as physically... healthy. It took her a while to sort of come into her own.
The one without the mojo got the better health.
Yes. Makeda. And Makeda would sometimes carry her sister Abby on her back. They have that closeness of siblings who are basically raised simultaneously. So they have a shared language. It is the language of, say, 9-year-olds, because that's when they stop speaking it, but they do have it. And they know each other so well that they know just how to get under each other's skins.
Mm.
But also, they can almost act like one person when things get difficult or scary or they need to move fast. They're so used to moving together that they barely need to share words about it.
And what you are not saying, because it's not your place, you're really the writer, is that I pick up the book. It's a page-turner.
Is it?
I read it. I read it in... I haven't done this in years. I read it in, like, 14 continuous hours. I picked up the book. And when the day was over, I had finished it.
Oh,
and I took
you.
My time. And I don't think I've done that since I was, like, in my 20s.
That's the best thing you could say to a writer.
I was just, totally brought into it. And I don't want to hear from guys that this is women's. I don't want to hear from other people that this is a book for people of color. This is just really wonderful, all-engrossing book. I really loved it.
Thank you.
The next thing that I have to ask you, this is like the follow-up from the ReaderCon interview, is at that point you were just coming out of a very dire period in your life, and now you look wonderful.
Thank you.
And the book reads wonderfully. So a page has been turned. What happened?
Yes. My partner and I spent 5 years quite destitute, two of them homeless, and traveling to wherever anybody would put us up. And science fiction community, queer community, family, Toronto community, people in Reading who we hadn't known before then, people in the UK in general, people in the US, just sort of helped us keep going. It's a wonderful thing that I can never stop being grateful for. In the interim...
I saw your sort of re-emergence into the world was happening through Twitter.
Yeah.
How I saw it.
Yes, that's exactly what was happening. I'm there by hangs a tail. And then I
got... The Mallow Spring.
My partner and I had decided actually to have a commitment ceremony because we at that point had been together about 13 years and gotten through this, we're getting through this tough period.
And I first met you when you two first met.
Yes, yes. And I woke up the morning of the ceremony and looked in the fridge of the house where we were guests at that moment, staying in someone's room, and I had one egg, a tablespoon full of strawberry jam, and a handful of gluten-free flour. That was what we had for that, till the foreseeable future, until we could, you know, somehow make some money happen and buy some more food. And I thought, what can I do with this to make something celebratory? And I stole some milk from our... I'm sure they wouldn't have minded. And made crepes. And was so proud of myself that I had these strawberry crepes. That I took a picture and tweeted it. And under the hashtag, I think that's when I started using the hashtag, food is good. So
I saw them two hashtags.
So people who... I mean, I'm a writer. I can take 140 characters and make anything sound good. So I started tweeting my meals. And people don't realize that it came out of trying to feed two people on one egg and a tablespoon of strawberry jam. However, in the interim, I got offered a position at the University of California, Riverside. I am now... they made me a full professor. I am part of a three-faculty research cluster based around the Eaton Collection, which is an archive of science fiction open to the public. It's the largest archive of science fiction open to the public. We're doing programming around it. And I'm in the creative writing department as a science fiction and fantasy writer. I think that is unheard of. It's the only position I've ever heard of like it.
Yeah, Joanna Russ was teaching creative writing at Harper.
Yes.
But she was not there to teach science fiction and fantasy and just about lost her tenure. Because that's what she was doing, and because it's the year she published The Female Man.
Horrors. Yes, by God, take that woman's tenure away for they writing did. One of the...
they did, but the three lawsuits later, but...
Oh, my God, no wonder she hurt.
Yes.
Yeah. So, I teach you all kinds of fiction, but that's why I'm there. And I gotta tell you, having an income... is a lovely thing.
Yeah, I'd like to do it one of these.
Yeah, I know. I recommend it.
No, I really...
Everyone should have one.
There was a time that I actually was a network... I ran networks, including for a bank, a major bank, and all that. But this is 15 years ago, and then I was writing about tech, but the bottom fell out of the tech magazine industry.
And I got to say that this is a, it's a writing position. They presume that I'm writing it. It's part of my job, so...
That's wonderful.
The teaching load's fairly low. And so I have time to write.
Okay, so that's a wonderful story for us. And like your fiction, that's a fabulous springboard where we will simply imagine what is to come after one is done reading the book. It's now, we now know there will be more books. And I hope, by the way, stories? You have another story collection coming up?
I am shopping around a short story collection. I have a short story, a young adult short story coming out in Kelly Link and Gavin Grant's new anthology, Monstrous Affections. The story's called Left Foot Right. So yes, the writing is being slow at this point. I think I'm still in recovery. My stamina for writing is fairly low. I'm doing a lot of it, but not...
But you're going to be moving near the university where you're teaching.
I am quite near. I'm a mile away. I'm going to be moving further away from the university. I'm heading for L.A.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
But
you were an East Coaster and not so much, which is one of the reasons I haven't seen you frequently.
Yeah.
But I hope to see you more frequently. And I have broken my rule about not doing phone interviews, at least with people that I know.
Okay. Right.
I won't do that with writers I don't know. But so we're going to follow this up at some point. And it's so wonderful seeing you.
It is very good to see you.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
That was Nalo Hopkinson, recorded March 28th, 2014, at a hotel in Brooklyn where there was a Black Writers Conference, and very grateful to have been able to do it. It's been about 7 years since I had the opportunity to interview Nahlo. Coming up next will be a movie review, again by Dan Persons, that he was planning to put on last week's program, but the tragic loss of Robert Knight to WBAI, and in fact to us all everywhere, made it needful to not do my program last week. But we will put Dan's review in. So, here it is.
I'm Dan Persons, and welcome to a special edition of the Hour of the Wolf movie review, something that came out on home video not quite a year ago, an Asian horror ghost story. You know, all them spirits with issues to work out and shambling spectral women with their hair covering their faces and lots of creepy, weird stuff without a lot of explanation for why it's going on. But let's mix it up a bit. Let's set this at a military training base in Singapore. Yep, Singapore horror. I didn't even know Singapore had a film industry, but there you go. The film is called 2359, as in soldier speak for just before midnight, which is not a bad metaphor for the kind of ethereal chills director Gilbert Chan indulges in here. The focus is on one barracks and the group of young soldiers in training there. It's your typical mix. There's the aggressive jerk, the delicate misfit, the sympathetic guy, and the obese comic relief. But that's where things break away. The bully, contrary to cliche, is the one who believes in vengeful spirits, while the sympathetic guy, having become estranged from his father after having been used to run a fake medium scam, has no patience for ghost stories. Their sergeant, meanwhile, the one you'd presume to be the voice of reason, is the one giving his men talismans to carry with them while on training marches, and when one man dies under mysterious circumstances during a march, and it appears his dead soul has entered the body of the superstitious jerk, it's the sergeant who defies the orders of his superior to bring in the Asian equivalent of an exorcist. By the way, this isn't an exorcism story. That's just one element of a film that incorporates suicidal soldiers, forest-dwelling spirits, and numerous flashbacks to fill in the details of various myths and legends, including the local legend of a medium whose deformed child may be the cause for all this paranormal evil. In the tradition of J-horror, the Japanese version of Asian horror, the film is overstuffed with what seems to be weird stuff for weird stuff's sake. Not all that happens makes sense within the greater context of the story. For instance, that whole possession bit just ends apparently because nobody could think of anything else to do with it, and the flashbacks, instead of being more fully sculpted mini-narratives, tend to take the form of this happened, and then this happened, and then this spooky thing happened. It actually works better when you consider the film as a whole, but seems a little blunt in the moment. But the film has genuine strengths that raise it above the Asian horror baseline. Part of that is contextual, setting the story on a military base and enacting it with a largely male cast certainly breaks it out of the norm. Country of origin also has an effect. The base is located on a small or smallish island in 1983. I'm not sure if that date is relevant, but the relations between the military and the locals seem to play into the tale. Interestingly, the dialogue is a combination of Mandarin and English, whether that's a remnant of the nation's former status as a British settlement or some sort of result of the military's close association with the Israeli military. Israel has been a key supplier of equipment to Singapore. I don't know, but it does make for a humorous moment when the sergeant grouses about his commander being a Caucasian wannabe. Above and beyond the uniqueness of the stage, though, director Chan has managed to create an atmospheric and surprisingly poignant tale. not a lot of gore to it. Makeup effects don't always sell, and Chan's attempt to navigate the jerk into a more sympathetic role isn't completely credible, but the story is creepy and compelling. It does turn out that all or most of the weirdness can be justified, and the resolution and the repercussions thereof are moving in ways that separate this film from the Asian horror norm. 2359 does have the stuff that fans of Asian horror look for, but blazes its own engaging and quite satisfying trail. And it's available on DVD or over at Amazon Instant Video, so it's easy and relatively cheap to check out. I'm Dan Persons. Remember, we're now archiving these reviews over at CineFantastique Online, so you can catch up with what you missed.
And the website for that is cfq.com. This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. You can learn more about the program and have your say at ourwolf.com, HOURWOLF.com, or join the Hour of the Wolf group on Facebook. Just type in Hour of the Wolf on their search engine and you will find it and you can join it. Also, an important note that I probably should have mentioned earlier, that on May 13th, Andrea Hairston will be performing a play with original music by Pan Morrigan and a cast of, well, six, at the New York Review of Science Fiction readings. And I will give you all of those details when I am back next week. By the way, next week's show begins at 1 a.m. So, thank you all for listening. My name is Jim Freund. This has been Hour of the Wolf. Stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clappers with Lister. Good morning.
To Rather Station, WBAI, 99.5 FM, New York. WBAI.org, 58 minutes after 2 o'clock. Thank you, Jim Freund.
The people all around the people. work. Tell me I'm wrong, though, that's my right in this writing. The Constitution, yo, that's an illusion. Huh, suckers trying to change and rearrange. They said that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover. The red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm the lover of this flag, like many others take the same turn. Like me, they yearn for the flag too. Infernal, cause my hurt is internal. The American dream, a nightmare. I want the people to wake up to the lies, the pigs make up. Imperialistic swans that I grind into bacon bits. Call the fist, cause I ain't taking shit. I'm not a Nazi or a Cappy or a Farmy, but you want me in prison, cause I'm pissing your tag. The flag, I ragging and snagging and dragging and ripping to shreds. Cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded cause I make the pigs dribble when I burn a symbol. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy, I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy. So just hand me a flag from the fastest and watch me burn that piece up to ashes. Cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn. Let's find the people who hate this. These are the places we'll hit.
Panama, talking about Peru, Azania, Brixton, Belfast, can't forget Korea, Beirut, can't forget Haiti, Iran, Puerto Rico, Colombia, Mexico. Talk about Uptown, Harlem, New York City, y'all. And Nicaragua, East and South Central LA, California, IA, Miami. Do or die, Bed-Stuy, never ran, never will, Brownsville. Boogie down, South Bronx, yeah.
My man Joey to jail, and now they got him in court because he burned the flag. That's the name of the game. Well, I quit playing. I doubt the suckers want you to hear what I'm saying about this nation. Freedom supposed to be the format, but I step on your flag like it's a floor mat. Maim and mangle, the star spangled. I'm not trying to diss you. I use the flag like toilet tissue to wipe my black ass. What? You think that I'm a jackass? I see a flag and I attack fast with some fire. My desire to burn what Betty Ross sold up. The truth I show up about America, America, home of the brave, land of the free. Boom! This is the home of the slave. Now hold on, just a mother minute. You gave me freedom of speech in the First Amendment. So why wanna scold me when I torch the flag? I'm only doing what you told me. You don't like it, so what? I'm not scared of you. Your flag, America too. See, I made up this new rule and I want y'all to learn it. Strike a match to the American flag and burn.
before she devout. I'm gonna pray to no Selassie I the first. We don't do that with no dogmatic leader. No, we don't. We make proletariat revolution. Yes. HR, burn baby burn, y'all. Fire.
Try to make a discipline child. Yeah. Try to make a discipline child.
Yeah.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Love this record.
Love it. Try to make a discipline child.
212-209-2900. Listen right here. Don't forget we're fundraising. All of this week, the whole month, right here at 99 Sinker. Do support us right here. You know what to do, right? Jacob Killer Miller. I hear Ziggy Marley talk about he's making a reggae album unlike any other reggae album that has never been made before. Sounds a little bit revisionist, Ziggy. Yo, you ever hear a group named Block Yahuru? How they changed the face of reggae, gave it a brand new direction? Have you ever heard of a cat called Jacob Killer Miller when I'm feeling blue?
When I'm feeling great, I stop to meditate. Into my own, own thing, yeah. I'm still trying to find some old peace of mind. Yeah.